Welcome back, everybody. It's now 6 minutes past five. Section five is what we're now looking at on the agenda.
Madam, apologies. Before we move on to section five, might I make one small intervention? Estelle Dehan for North Norfolk District Council. On landscape and visual matters, we noted that this agenda didn't deal with the 10-year replacement planting matter. And you may have noticed that there's been some movement on that and that the applicant has committed to 10-year aftercare for trees, subject to landowner agreement. But we remain of the view that it needs to be a 10-year replacement planting period for all planting, including hedgerows. The only reason that I interject is to say that it would be incredibly helpful for us to know if you feel that further evidence is needed from North Norfolk District Council on this matter so that we know where we can focus our resources. I'm very grateful.
You're quite right. We didn't pick it up because there are written questions about it. But now I think we can, it's definitely covered under written questions, and those are out fairly soon. So I think that would be our preferred option at present. But the point you've made, we have noted.
I'm very grateful. We'll have our people lined up. Thank you.
Excuse me, could I just clarify also whether you need to hear anything more from our landscape specialist, Joe Phillips, who's here, but has come a long way to be here and needs to leave reasonably soon to get back.
No, we both nodded to that, shook our heads to that, no, thank you.
Thank you.
So in the interest of making sure that we do finish in good time, we're turning to item five. What our plan is now is we will take item five, the first item in relation to the 1996 crash, and then items two and three, we will put into a written question on item five. And then it is our plan to put item one and two of item six into a written question, but we would still very much like to keep item three of six on the agenda for today, please. And I'm looking across at the applicant because we have asked you to do a presentation in relation to that point. And then, indeed, I've been asked if we would put up the written question as item one of B on page six. So we will put that through as a written question, which then leaves us under B with item two to finish our hearing. Okay. Was that clear? Good. Let's proceed then.
Just to say that we have read with care the submissions that have been made, both at deadline one and deadline two, with expression of concern about the potential effects to water supplies and indeed to aquifers from disturbance of land in the area of the plane crash. So rather than revisit those representations, let's just ask the applicant, if we may, whether there's a particular approach that you have to this, let's call it this risk of contamination.
Perhaps I could pass over to Claire Davis on this point. Thank you.
Claire Davis on behalf of the applicant. So yes, with regards to the plane crash, this was considered in the environmental statement in chapter 19 as a potential historical source of contamination. There is a report from the Royal Air Force that details the remediation that was taking place in the vicinity of the site, but we acknowledge that included armament specialists and hydrazine experts. That report identified there was obviously debris from the crash, as well as other potential contaminants, with regards to hydrazine, oil products, fuel, etc. So that was considered in our preliminary conceptual model that's presented as Appendix 2 of the ES. And the area was identified as a source of historic contamination. Obviously, we have the remediation report, and we believe that the site has been remediated based on the report from the Royal Air Force. However, we do acknowledge that there is a risk of potentially some residual contamination being in place, and we propose to undertake site investigation works to confirm if there is any residual contamination in place at the site of the plane crash, and it would likely involve retrieval of soil samples, groundwater, surface water samples, groundwater monitoring. So we acknowledge that the historical site, we acknowledge the potential presence for residual contamination and intend to investigate that prior to the commencement of construction.
Thank you. I suppose the only other question then is, there's a time implication here, and that of course is a post-consent matter. But have you had preliminary discussions with the Environment Agency on what that process will entail and what kind of feedback loop there is likely to be with the EA?
Claire Davis on behalf of the applicant. So discussions have been had with the Environment Agency over the site, and I believe the matter is covered within the Statement of Common Ground with the Environment Agency. Obviously, with the site being remediated, it's never been designated as a it's not designated as a contaminated site in its current state. So it would be a case of kind of precautionary site investigations, and the plane crash, along with some other sites identified along the route, which the Environment Agency have suggested we do preliminary investigations with, so they are aware that we're planning those works. We haven't as yet developed a timetable for them, but the idea was that we would consult with the Environment Agency on the proposed scope of those works and prior to undertaking them.
Let me just ask if that brings some degree of comfort to Necton Parish Council.
I'll just go first then. Jenny Smidley, Necton Substation Action Group, not Parish Council, sorry. With the Vanguard project, there was a very, very comprehensive conditions set out by John Berry of Breckland Council. Now, one would have thought that you would just simply have to follow that for Boreas, because you might say that if Boreas goes ahead and Vanguard goes ahead, you'd have already done it for Vanguard, but if Boreas goes alone as in option two, you won't have done it. And that contamination spreads over a much wider area. And as the panel will know, if they've read the crash reports, it was complete chaos. The site was left unmanned for 2 weeks during snow. A load of soil was incorrectly moved as being clean when it was actually dirty, and then it was put back again and had to be looked at again. And, you know, we're talking about quite some time ago. And debris from the crash actually rained down over Ivy Todd Farm and was seen, the fuel came down as little candles lit up coming down, so heaven knows what else came down. There was also some missiles on the plane. We don't know how many. I've spoken to the Danish Air Force about this, and they're very, very cagey. And in fact, the person they've got in charge of answering queries is the pilot of the plane, who was actually taken to task very severely because
To be concise, we have read your submission.
That's it.
Did you have anything to add? Yes.
Alice Spain, Necton Parish Council. Just one point that I'd like to raise. Saying the ground was remediated, it was remediated to 18 inches. Now, if your foundations and all your digging are not going to go below 18 inches, then Necton Parish Council do not have a concern. But if anything that you do is going beyond 18 inches, then we do have a concern. We had a significant interaction with Breckland because they would not involve the Environment Agency because this was historical. They didn't wish to involve the Environment Agency. And so the lady from the Environment Agency came to see me and they would have liked to have been involved. And I don't believe that we have closed the loop on this particular issue. Thank you.
Thank you. I think in the interest of moving on the agenda, could I ask if you would write in as a post-hearing note on this, including, if you would, the reference to the Breckland report that you've just referred to. I think it would be very helpful if you could liaise with Breckland, perhaps whilst you're together, and have that report submitted to the examination. I'm not aware that it has already been submitted.
Sorry, Alice Spain from Necton Parish Council. It was part of the Vanguard examination process, and I recognise that you don't have access to that information, but we can forward it to you without a problem.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Then let's turn now to item 6 on the agenda, unless the applicant wants to come back on anything before we move on. Right. Then we'll turn now to item 6. And just to say, in relation to the first point, A, Roman numeral 1, we're still not persuaded by the applicant's responses in relation to this stage and phase debate. So we would ask that you go back and see if there's anything further you can do to give us some level of comfort that's clear and will work through in a sensible way. So, yeah, it's still troubling us. Thank you. And we will put that into a written question, and anybody else is welcome to comment, but I just wanted to explain why we're asking you that.
Claire Davies, on behalf of the applicant, would providing some examples of what those stages might be, would that assist in that, address that point?
Exactly, as indeed we've set out here. I think the way to make us understand what you're trying to do or propose to do is to give us some examples. Yeah. And if you could contextualise it by referring to how the discharging authorities and the district councils would interface, that would also be useful. So if we could just have some case studies, for example, that would be useful. Thank you. And also item 2, under A, we've said we'll put into a written question. So then that leaves us moving to item Roman numeral 3, which I'll ask Ms. Coombs to take us through, please.
Well, I was sort of hoping you'd come prepared to talk about that, so if you could go through. I think there's just, there's still, in our minds, lack of clarity between the requirements and the OCOP. So just to go through that as we set out in the agenda.
Claire Davies, on behalf of the applicant. So I believe we have on screen the annex, which shows the relationship of the different DCO requirements and their associated plans. So the COCP, the COCP, I believe, is this requirement there. So that's governed by requirement 20. The plan shows the requirements along the top and then how it relates to the outline plans. And then along the bottom, identifies the different elements that will be included within the Code of Construction Practice. They're also then, so in terms of the COCP, it covers the various topics along the bottom, which are listed in the DCO, which cover a range of environmental topics, air quality, noise, etc. I won't list them out for the sake of being brief. There is then additional requirements that cover So other environmental topics are covered by separate requirements. So you have requirements, I think, 18 and 19. Apologies, I can't see it well, so I'm slightly guessing. Which cover landscape, which also relate to the outline plan. There is additional specific traffic requirement, and that relates to the different outline traffic documents in terms of the access, the traffic travel, and the traffic management plan. There's a separate requirement with regards to the archaeology, which has its own outline plan and the outline WSI. And ecology obviously will have its own separate ecology management plan and is defined by the OLEMs. So in terms of when we're referring to separate requirements that are governed by separate plans, we are referring to things like the archaeology, the ecology, the landscape that are governed by separate plans. When we are talking about subsidiary plans within the COCP, that will be the plans to do with all the elements along the bottom. So within the final COCP, there'll be a construction noise plan, an artificial lighting plan, etc. So if it's helpful, we can show the table in the COCP, if that's helpful as well. Or
yes, that would be, yep.
So there is, so I'll continue while there we go, the table comes up. So within the COCP, because it is the Code of Construction Practice, we outline within it which plans are subsidiary, which plans are separate but related. So the elements that are listed at the start of the table are the ones that are specifically covered by the COCP. So those are A to N listed within the DCO, covering the different topics, construction, soil management, air quality, etc. So these will be what we reference as subsidiary plans that will be contained within the final COCP. And then the final section of the table refers to those environmental topics that are specifically, have their own specific requirements. So they're not, so there's be additional controls on those topics because they are covered by a separate requirement. So in terms of the OLEMs, the traffic, the archaeology, and also the design and action statement, and they're included within that table because as a signposting exercise to ensure that during construction, the Code of Construction Practice tends to be the kind of main focus document, and we've included those in there to make sure that contractors are also aware that there are other related plans that they will also need to adhere to. So that would be the OLEMs, the Written Scheme of Investigation for Archaeology, etc. So that's in terms of explaining kind of how those they sit kind of in parallel, but obviously we like to have the cross references between the two so nothing kind of gets missed during the kind of construction phase. We do acknowledge that there is in some instances some overlap between some of the information in the Code of Construction Practice and primarily in the OLEMs. So for example, in the Code of Construction Practice there is a section on fencing, because one of the requirements of the COCP is the final one will contain all the details of the fencing requirements. One of those fencing requirements is tree protection, so there is an overlap in that sense, and an appropriate cross reference between the two documents is there. So we feel that that is appropriate, that is covered by both, because to make sure that the tree protection fencing requirements are detailed in the COCP, but obviously the details of what that tree protection measure will be is defined by the OLEM. So there is a certain amount of cross-reference between some of the topics. But generally, what the COCP covers is the topics that are covered in the requirement. And then, like I say, we've added the cross-reference in the table to the ones that are covered by separate requirements with regards to archaeology, ecology, etc.
So is anything that is covered within one of the outline plans would be required to be undertaken in accordance with what the COCP says? Or if it needs to be, then you're saying there's a cross reference there in the relevant plan. Have I understood correctly?
Claire Davis on behalf of the applicant. So yeah, so all construction works will be in accordance with the outline code of construction and the final code of construction practice. If there is a specific topic, for example, where the requirement is both ecological and the details of it are also required under the COCP, there is a cross reference. But it means that the COCP is applicable to all construction works, and then obviously that then cross-references, for example, to the OLEMs for details of what those trees, specifically the mitigation for trees, would be, because that's an ecological and landscape issue, as opposed to there isn't an ecological and landscape section within the COCP. That's covered by a separate document because of how extensive it will be.
And are there any other, shall I say, daughter documents to any of the outline plans? Or is everything, the reason I ask is I think you've submitted a hedgerow mitigation strategy recently. So would that be incorporated on an updated version of this diagram?
Claire Davis on behalf of the applicant. So yes, there is a recent additional commitment in the OLEMs to produce a hedgerow plan. That will be part of the final ecological management plan. So we could produce an updated figure to show there where that would sit. As far as I can recall, that would be the only subsidiary plan of the other outline documents other than the COCP.
So if any other documents of that nature arise during the course of examination, I think it would be helpful if they could be included in this. And can you just talk me through the sort of matter, if it was a pre-commencement activity, then that would also be covered by the eventual COCP, is that correct?
So the pre-commencement activities are covered with the constraints that are in, obviously they will go ahead before the final COCP will be published, but the details set out for the pre-commencement works can be included as part of the final COCP. So, Claire Davis on behalf of the applicant. So to clarify, the pre-commencement works will have their own kind of separate mini plan, so they to cover those works that will be discharged prior to the COCP. However, obviously, we can they'll be part of the final CP, probably as subsidiary documents as well.
So do we have an outline of that at present?
Claire Davis, on behalf of the applicant. So at this stage, we haven't provided any outline plans for the site, the advanced site preparation works, because a lot of the principles will be drawn on what's in the outline code of construction practice, so it will take the relevant bits of the outline code of construction practice that are relevant to whichever site preparation works it's being prepared for. So the mitigations are covered in the COCP, but they'll be just drawn out and made site specific for the works, for the site prep works being undertaken.
Do you think we could just have a note to cover that?
Claire Davis on behalf of the app. We can have a note to kind of cover how that will work as well.
Thank you. Deadline 4?
That was a nod.
I can confirm, yeah, we can produce that for deadline 4.
And we'll be coming back to this topic tomorrow in relation to the DMLs, but we won't stray offshore at this stage. Item Roman numeral 4, we have sort of addressed earlier today, unless someone's telling me otherwise. And then that leaves us to, does North Norfolk want to say anything in relation to that? Excellent. So that leaves us to the last item of the day, which is item B, Roman numeral 2. It's an open question to the local authorities. And in part, this flows from concerns which we haven't discussed in any detail today in relation to things like a compensation fund for residents and businesses affected by construction. So we just would like to have a view from each of the local authorities, if you would, please, about your views in relation to post-consent approval and resourcing and where you are on that general topic, please, and then I'll invite the applicant to respond. But I think, could I start with North Norfolk and then work up the line to understand where you each are in relation to your roles as discharging authorities and how you might go about this and where you are in terms of your thinking.
Jeff Lyon from North Norfolk District Council. We don't have specific resources allocated for this particular task at this moment in time. Obviously, we're some way off from having to discharge requirements.
And I would caveat this, that there is no certainty or any recommendation at this stage relating to Norfolk Boreas or indeed the other offshore wind farms. Yeah. So it is very much with that caveat in mind.
Yeah. And this is obviously hypothetical in terms of that situation. We do have internal expertise, so we have our own landscape officers, we have ecologists as well. So we are better placed than some of the authorities to have our own internal expertise to help us with discharge of requirements. As I say, we don't have a dedicated resource, so this would be on top of the day-to-day work that we're doing in terms of maintaining five-year housing land supplies and other sort of requirements that we have in the major project team. But it's the thing we would want to understand is the time frame for when we expect this to start so we can gear up to having resources in place. Now, we do need to have a discussion with the applicant about how we would resource that. There's opportunities for planning performance agreements, those sort of approaches that we could have outside of the DTO process with the applicant, so we can give some kind of certainty about time frame for getting responses back. Because that's the big thing. You don't want to start a project not having the resources in place to ensure we can get a timely response back. Because if otherwise, it just becomes difficult for everybody involved. So really, we'd want to have that discussion. Assuming it was, let's say it was a positive outcome in terms of a DTO decision, we'd want to kind of think about timelines so we can start thinking about the resources that we need to do that. But we're clear from the requirements what's needed of us in terms of what we need to discharge. It's just knowing when we need to get that resource in place to do that.
Okay, Matthew Rook from Broadland District Council. Similar to Jeff, really, it is a resource issue. Slightly different for Broadland that we don't have our own ecologists. We use Norfolk County Council's ecologists, so there would be quite a bit of crossover and liaison with Norfolk County Council in some of their functions. But it would be a recognition that where we need to come to a decision and discharge in some of the requirements, we would use those officers best placed to do that. But yeah, we think we need some more discussion with the applicants around that, and not something that we've done as yet.
Simon Wood, Breckland Council, echoing a lot of what my colleagues have said in terms of the need to speak to the applicant about elements such as planning performance agreements and how those may be used to fund additional resources. We have no landscape and design expertise in-house, which, given that we will be dealing with a large substation, is something that we will need to resource in some capacity. We have in-house arboricultural support. We also utilize NCC Ecology for ecological advice. So it's a more or less the same as my colleagues to my left. Discussions with the applicant, identifying the timelines, identifying the resources needed, and how best to fund that and bring that forward.
And so it would hinged from what I'm hearing from all three authorities upon a planning performance agreement being agreed with the applicant. Is that a reasonable summation of each of your positions? Yeah, thank you. And where is the applicant on this? What appetite has the applicant have to enter into these discussions with the local authorities should a recommendation to grant development consent be given by the Secretary of State?
Claire Davis on behalf of the applicant. So yes, the applicant is happy. So discussions have been undertaken previously for Norfolk Vanguard with regards to signing into the planning performance agreement, and we'd be prepared to do the same for Norfolk, but we ask in turn to be able to cover the time and skills required from the local authorities. So that is something that we will be prepared to be enter into, and also obviously enter into the discussions with regards to timescales and the process that will be need to do. So we'll be more than happy to engage as soon as possible once there is a positive, if there is a positive decision. Definitely have an appetite to enter that conversation and work with the local authorities on the timescales and the best way to discharge those conditions.
So there is a... Yes, let me just ask North Norfolk to come back on that.
Just wanted to make an observation. Jeff Lyon from North Norfolk District Council. One of the issues facing North Norfolk and other local authorities is actually recruiting planning officers at the moment. There is a shortage of skilled planning officers in the local authority network. So... yes, if we get a PPA performance agreement to resource a post, that's great, but it's actually finding the people that's the hard bit. So that's the fly in the ointment, so to speak, in terms of making sure there's a smooth transition from a consent through to a requirement discharge. So it's that's something that we're facing. We're trying to resolve ourselves internally, but it's a challenge that we think we need to recognise when we're sort of taking forward a PPA route.
So in our consideration of an application such as this, it's reasonable for us to look at discharging authorities and whether they are resourced to enable them to do what is being required of them. In other cases, there would be planning obligations in place that would be signed and sealed by the end of the examination, to which we could afford some weight. How would a PPA that was in discussion but not signed or formalised, how would the panel have confidence that that was something we could afford some weight to in our consideration of whether planning authorities and highway authorities, albeit they're not here, are resourced to enable them to do the job that's been asked of them?
I think the short point is that it's the incentive is for the applicant to ensure that this is right, sorted out, because it's in their interest to have a smooth discharge process, properly resourced. Otherwise, there's a danger of the discharge process getting bogged down and not proceeding according to the timescale that the applicant requires on a fast-moving project. There have already been discussions with Norfolk County Council as well in that context, and as far as I'm aware, they're content with the position as it stands at the moment. But subject to any further comments you've got, it was not the intention for the applicant to try to agree a PPA at this stage. Because there are still probably a number of imponderables that need to be factored in before that can be done, not least establishing the relative division of labour between the different authorities, the possibility of having a coordinator who might come in and pull together the various resources from the different authorities and ensure that they were dealt with on a consistent basis. So at this stage, I think the main reassurance we can give is that it is very much in our interest to to have it sorted out and deal with that in due time.
Do you think a potential Secretary of State would be reassured by that?
I'm not aware that in the past there has been any issue over this and the Secretary of State wanting to be reassured beyond the sort of discussion we've just had. And certainly in past wind farm, the wind farm, offshore wind farm DCO examinations, I'm not aware that there's been any issue about getting a PPA in place before the expiry of the examination. And I think in many cases it's been a similar situation to the one we've got now, where it's been in the applicant's interest to sort it out. There's been an explanation of the there's a discussion as to whether the authorities are uncomfortable about not having a PPA in place at this stage, and as far as I'm aware, the response has always been that they're content to let it take its course and be sorted out on a proper basis.
North Norfolk.
Madam, thank you. Estelle de Hon for North Norfolk District Council. I think, with respect, that must be correct, that I don't see a way in which, in similar to a Section 106, that this could be secured via the DCO process. And I think the best that can be done is to take into account as some kind of material consideration the clear indication given by the applicant of what the intention would be. But that couldn't be secured via the DCO. It might be able to be recorded within a decision as something that had been taken into account, but the weight to be given to that would have to be reflected in the fact that it couldn't be secured in the same way as a Section 106. That would give everybody an indication of what was said. It would give some security to the local authorities. But because this is the DCO process, I think that genuinely is the best that can be anticipated.
So, I mean, it is slightly different from a Section 106 because we would look to CSIN Section 106 from all parties, and that would give us, well, between the two parties, that would afford us a weight that is there, which would be slightly different from what we are here. So, and it's not that we're looking at trying to secure it into a DCO. I think we're just mulling over what we're hearing from the local authorities and understanding the climate within which local authorities are operating, just trying to then think through with the applicant how a degree of comfort could be provided in our consideration of future discharge responsibilities. So that's really where we're coming from. I don't think we were thinking of requiring a PPA, more understanding the weight that we might potentially attribute to a commitment to talk about something in the future. That's really where we were. Yes, North.
It would be feasible, of course, to sign some kind of commitment outside of the DCO process. But again, the weight that could be given to that, I suppose, would be a matter for you, given that it would be a commitment signed outside of the DCO process.
Okay. And does the applicant want to come back on that?
No, I don't think so. I do stand corrected in that there have been PPAs in certain cases entered into before the end of the examination. Possibly Rampion was one of them. yes, and I mean, I think one has to draw a distinction between a 106, where the obligations are entered into to in response to mitigating direct impacts of the project, where clearly those are matters to be taken into account. In this case, we've got a situation, perhaps one could say it's more akin to the community benefit argument, whereby there are discussions going on about possible extra examination type support for communities, but those discussions are proceeding separately. And in the same way, there are separate discussions going on about possible support to the local authorities to accommodate them. But again, I repeat, it's in the applicant's interest to make sure this happens, because the last thing the applicant wants is to find that the discharge process is slowed down because of lack of resources with the discharging authorities.
Indeed, and I don't doubt the applicant's desire. I'm just conscious of the ability of the discharging authorities to meet that. What I would ask you to do, if you would, is just to reflect upon this point, and to see if you have any other comments in relation to it. I think it's something that we're certainly mulling over. Okay. Does anyone else wish to raise any other matter before I close the hearing? And I'm just going to look around, not ask individually, but look for any indication. And the panel? So thank you for your attendance and involvement today. We knew it would be quite a hefty day, and it has been, but your engagement's, as always, much, much appreciated. And we'll see some of you back here tomorrow. And safe journey home. Thank you very much. And I'll close the hearing at 1746.